Hello and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of arts and culture. I'm Sarah Cahill, filling in for host David LaTulipe, and today, Celia Fuchsiel from Smuin Ballet will tell us about the remaining Bay Area performances of the company's 20th anniversary season. Solo performer Mark Kenward shares stories from Nantucket, his memoir about growing up on the legendary island. He's currently at the Marsh in Berkeley. Diane Keough offers her reviews on some current cultural experiences, and book critic and regular contributor Peter Robinson will be here as well. All this during the next hour here on Open Air. Celia Fuchsiel, it's great to have you in the studio.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks very much for coming. You're artistic director of the Smuin Ballet, and you have the remaining performances of your 20th anniversary season currently in production.
Exactly. Sometime. We're in Mountain View right now through Sunday, and in 2 weeks we'll close at the Sunset Center in Carmel.
Great. That's very exciting. And this is the series called...
Eccentric.
Eccentric.
Yeah, this whole season, our theme has been the double X, the Roman numeral for 20, because it's our 20th anniversary season. It was a little take on that, and so we spelled eccentric with a double X. And in a way, it shows the diversity of Smuin. It's a very diverse program, quite varied, and it shows the talents of the dancers beautifully. The versatility of each and every artist.
Now, Michael Smuin founded the company in 1994.
94.
Is that right?
Exactly.
And you were with the San Francisco Ballet at the time?
Well, no, I knew Michael in the early 80s when I was dancing at the San Francisco Ballet. Mm. And when he started his company in 93, he asked me to come and work with him. So he had already known me from SFB. And so I was the first dancer he approached, and I was also ballet master at the time, and he later promoted me to associate director. And I was performing through August of 2006. And when I retired to focus on being associate director full-time, sadly, 8 months later, Michael passed away. So I never expected myself to be thrust into this position, but we're delighted to see the company thriving as it has.
Now, he started the company in 1994 to infuse ballet with the rhythm, speed, and syncopation of American popular culture. So that's a very specific goal. It's interesting because we think of great American companies, Martha Graham, and any number of great American companies. But this is specifically American culture. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think that because of Michael's history with dance, he was not strictly a ballet dancer. He started learning how to tap. He was inspired by Gene Kelly growing up in Montana and going to the movies and seeing Gene Kelly. He was thrilled by that. Fred Astaire, all of this very stylized ballroom-type dancing. At one time, he had a nightclub act that he went around with... touring with Xavier Cugat, went throughout Europe. So he studied many styles of dance.
Yeah.
And later, of course, he got into ballet after starting with tap. But he then worked on Broadway. He worked in movies. And he had such a wide range of styles from which he selected styles and works.
Yeah.
He drew from these different styles and brought them to the classical vocabulary. And so we have a little tagline at Smuin Ballet that we're beyond ballet because we don't do the tutu thing. We might use different types of music. As you know, Michael created a ballet to Sinatra, to the Beatles, and on this program we've got Gershwin. And we have tapping, we have ballroom, we have heels, we have point shoes, we have every type of dance. And I think with Michael, and probably what it is with Smuin, is that, you know, there's a fearlessness to try any style and just excel at everything we do. So this program really does show that broad spectrum beautifully.
And there's more information at smuinballet.org. That's S-M-U-I-N ballet.org for information about these performances of the Smuin Ballet. Tell us about the program.
which is going on now. Just sort of take us through the different...
Okay, there are three ballets on the program, mm-hmm. and we open with a premiere by Val Canaparoli. He created it on the company late last year, and we worked on it through the spring as he had time in his schedule to come and work with us. But he selected 11 different Vivaldi concertos. So I asked him to look into the classical realm to create a new piece, looking for balance on my program musically. And he chose Vivaldi. And he's got a little bit of everything in there. There's humor. There's some seriousness. There's a little bit of romance. There's relationship. It's not a story ballet, but he touches on all of these things. And when I asked him, what are you going to call your ballet? And he said, well, it kind of has everything but the kitchen sink in it. And I said, well, you can't call it that. We need a sexier title than that. And he said, I said, well, what about Italian? You're of Italian descent and you chose an Italian composer. Yeah. So we have Tutto Eccetto e Lavandino, literally everything but the kitchen sink. So
great.
So and it's with that sort of tongue-in-cheek humor that he approached this work. It was just fun and celebratory, quirky at times, but wonderful to see the company working with such synchronization, at times with lightning speed. It's been a really fun project for the company to work on. And then we shifted gears completely, and Amy Seiwert created her new piece to Cesaria Evora from the Cape Verde Islands, the Barefoot Diva. And these beautiful, lush melodies that are infused with these, of course, the Portuguese language and Caribbean feels, almost Brazilian feeling. But these beautiful melodies that... evoke such longing for their homeland and the very sad history that the Cape Verde Islands has in the history of slavery. So Amy just tapped into these beautiful feelings with these lovely, lush rhythms. And so a very different piece from the first one is her piece called But Now I Must Rest, which was a quote of hers when Cesaria was retiring. And they were, why are you stopping? She said, but now I must rest. She had had some health issues, and so anyhow, this was also a wonderful project for the dancers to work on, and Amy shared so much of the history going into it, so they really captured that feeling, that nuance of her music. And then we close with the Gershwin, which, as I looked through Michael's vast array of works, I thought, well, what shouts celebration more than the Gershwin? So Dancing with Gershwin closes the program.
Great, great. Do you remember the moment that you met Michael Smuin?
Absolutely. I had seen him and heard him on a god mic in a theater from the time I was 13. I used to come to train with the San Francisco Ballet School, and I would hear him on the mic. We were allowed to watch the dress rehearsals up in the top balcony at the Geary Theater when SFB used to have a summer season. And it wasn't until I was 17 when I was actually had moved out here to train with the company. And the company teacher said, well, does Michael know you? And I said, well, I don't know if he knows who I am. I haven't met him. But so she grabbed me by the wrist and went to track Michael down. And this was Tatiana Grantseva, one of the guest teachers Michael had brought in to teach the company. And she said to Michael, this is Celia. She's a very good dancer. I think you should hire her. So that was my introduction to Michael.
That's fabulous. That's fabulous. When he started the company, the Smuin Ballet, it was with 10 dancers, is that right?
That's right.
And how many are there now?
16 dancers. And then we also have Shannon Hurlburt, who's closing out his dancing career. He's been with us for 16 years, so he's just doing the tapping in the Gershwin section. So at one point you'll see 17 out there, but we have 16 ballet dancers.
Interesting.
Doing the whole season this year.
I mean, it must have been so different for you from, you know, San Francisco Ballet, that the intensity of being with a small group of people, and I don't know. Tell us about what that was like.
It's been very different, but in a way back to my roots. I grew up in El Paso, Texas, and Ballet El Paso was a small regional company that I worked with. And it was like a small family, and that's very much what Smuin Ballet is like. I mean, The dancers are very close to one another. They support one another. They're in the wings cheering each other on. And it's not the large competitive atmosphere that I found San Francisco Ballet to be. I wasn't at SFB very long. I had a knee injury that took me out after a couple of years, so I wasn't there for that long, but it was long enough for me to meet Michael, and it was wonderful because I came here to dance for Michael. It just, the bulk of those years happened at Smion Ballet, which was just spectacular.
And the performances are this weekend at the Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts, and then June 6th and 7th at the Sunset Center in Carmel. Is that right?
That's right. Thursday and Friday at 8 p.m., Saturday 2 and 8, and then Sunday at 2 o'clock in Mountain View.
And more information at smuinballet.org, and that's S-M-U-I-N ballet.org. Can you tell us what it was like to be in Return of the Jedi?
Oh, that was funny. Michael, George Lucas was a big fan of Michael's, and so he hired Michael to choreograph this scene for the anniversary of the original trilogy. He wanted to drop in some scenes that he had not had the funds to do, and there, and some of it, the capability wasn't there to drop in some scenes, and so a lot of these were computer-generated. But there was a scene where three dancers were entertaining Jabba in his palace. And anyhow, we had to audition, and the casting director approved us to be in the film, and we went up to ILM in San Rafael and worked with George. He had not been behind the camera himself in 20 years, so it was pretty exciting. I initially had to go up for a costume fitting because I was wearing a full latex suit and a mask. I was Griotta, Greedo's sister. I'm a Rodian. I found out later when I some of the little boys in my son's class informed me that when they found out I was actually in the trilogy, and they said, "You're a Rodian. Did you know that?" Anyway, so we were sort of like the alien supremes entertaining Jabba in his palace. That's kind of how I refer to it. But I was in this full suit, and I had to wear a mask. And when I went for the costume fitting, it was like putting a plastic bag over your head.
Ooh.
And tightening it. And I never knew I was claustrophobic before that. But I guess if one has a bag over their head, they might panic just a bit. And so they actually said, "Well, you're going to have to practice taking it on and off and getting used to being in it longer and longer," because this had a slit up the back that would just be Velcroed shut, and it was completely enclosed. And so they sent me home with a mask that I was supposed to put on and try to wear for 2 minutes or 3 minutes or 4 minutes. And on the day of the shoot, George said, we'll only do, you know, at the most 15 minutes at a time. And the last shoot went for about 30 minutes. And I mean, I nearly collapsed because on the soundstage and the heat under the lights, it was quite incredible. And as soon as I put that mask on, I was just dripping and perspiring, wearing this huge latex suit. So all of me was covered up, and you won't recognize me in the film because I'm a reptilian creature.
Well, we'll know you're there though. That sounds very difficult. Yeah,
it was an interesting experience, and I'm amazed at the true meaning of fanatic, because I still get mail from all over around the world that people will take the time to actually research that and who dance that part and where I am and track me down and send me mail and ask me to sign a photo or something. It's quite amazing. So I think on my headstone it'll say, "Here lies Griotta." More people will know me as Griotta than as anyone with Smion Ballet.
Oh, that's a great story. The eccentric spring dance series, I have to admit, when I saw those double X's, I thought, ooh, that's very provocative, but it's two X's rather than three. eccentric spring dance series with the Smuin Ballet. And performance tonight? No, tonight
yes.
is, yes, tonight, tomorrow, and over the weekend. And
that's
two
right.
performances Saturday and Sunday.
One performance
each.
On Sunday. Just a matinee on Sunday.
Okay. All that information is at smuinballet.org. And thank you so much, Celia.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming in. Thank you.
Hey, sister, what you gonna do?
Going down by the river, gonna play with you.
Popping on right, no scream around here.
Don't live further, won't we chug that bear?
Sun, 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 sun.
gonna be, you gon' ladies of the marrying kind. Soon that food gon' rise like a huckleberry pie in the middle of the sky. Gon' be alright, gon' be alright.
It's Sunday morning, so make a joyful noise.
Joyful noise.
A joyful noise. Unto the Lord.
Hallelujah.
Today's the day God has made. It's Sunday.
Yes, sir.
Afloat for 40 days.
Cause the good Lord works in mysterious ways.
Come on, Celie. You're slow as molasses.
Celie not feeling good, Pa. She going as fast as she can.
Celie.
I'm sorry, Pa.
Nettie.
What you going to call?
You're listening to Open Air, weekly cultural arts show here on KALW. I'm Sarah Cahill, host of Revolutions Per Minute on Sunday evenings here on KALW, filling in for host David Latulip, who is in Scotland. Special thanks to producer Neil Swinkles and engineer Kevin Vance for today's show. We've just been listening to music from the musical version of The Color Purple, adapted from the book by Alice Walker, who won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. And the music and lyrics are by Marcia Norman, Brenda Russell, Allie Willis, and Stephen Brax. I'm here now with Diane Keough. Great to see you, Diane.
Nice to see you again, Sarah. I haven't seen you since the last time we did this.
Yes. And you just went to the Smuin Ballet performance.
I went to it last night and was blown away. The very first thing they had was Val's piece. I've never seen such a fluid, beautiful, soft, exciting piece of ballet. It was outstanding. The whole evening was outstanding, but that one really, really stuck with me. I can still visually see it. It was wonderful. I suggest anyone who likes ballet or thinks they might like ballet, go to see it. It will be there until Sunday at the, where am I?
It's at the Mountain View.
Mountain View Center for Performing Arts, yes.
For Performing Arts.
And the seating is wonderful, and the show is magnificent. So if you have the chance, and you like ballet, or you think you might like ballet, please go see it. It's wonderful. And now, the last music you heard was from The Color Purple, the musical, which I wasn't sure was going to be terribly good, because The Color Purple has some rather other intonations in it. You know, it's a story about racial oppression, domestic violence, spiritual crisis, and a couple of other things that are not so great. And the story is told through Celie, who is just as a teenager with two children that are taken from her, and then as her life of a wife, that's in quotes because they never got married, of an older, surly man that she was given to. And it talks about her life going on through becoming who she is, coming out from under the cloud through friendship and love. And I went into it when I went to see this, and it was at Hillbarn Theater. It still is at Hillbarn Theater, and it will be there until the 1st of June. It's an exciting performance. There are 23 in the cast. Their voices are magnificent. The choreography is great. It is an uplifting. There are tears. There is laughter. There is music. The music is anything that you might want to hear. Jazz, gospel, ragtime, blues, and it's all there and sung by a magnificent cast. The two people that I want to talk about the most are Leslie Ivey, who is Seeley. She carries the story, obviously. And Dawn L. Troop is Shug. A Shug is a person who has been a girlfriend of many men and sings and dances in clubs, but she comes because she's ill, and she comes, and Seeley ends up taking care of her. The two form a wonderful friendship. Shug ultimately gets her out from under all the hatefulness that she's been living with, and it comes to a wonderful ending. But Shug and Seeley really carry the story and really have magnificent voices, as do the rest of the cast, 23 people on a very small stage in Hill Barn, which is in San Mateo on Hillsdale. And when I first started going to Hill Barn, which was just this past year, I thought, I've never seen this, but I've heard a lot about it. Excuse me. And I got in, and I thought, well, this is a kind of a strange theater. It's got a small stage, but it's got a lot of seats to go kind of high. And I was blown away by it. The first thing I saw there was Spamalot, and I had seen the one in the city, and it was every bit as good as the one in the city. And these plays, put on by a cast of various people from various places, have been, every one of them, just marvelous. So if you have not seen Color Purple, the musical, and if you have seen the movie or if you've read the book, I suggest you go and see it. It will be there at June 1st. It's at 1285 East Hillsdale Boulevard in San Mateo. It's a marvelous program. Just marvelous.
Sounds great. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, 8 o'clock, and Sunday, 2 o'clock.
Right.
Are the show times.
Yeah, and it's the last show of the season for them, and I can't tell you enough good things about that small theater. It's I think they're in their 54th year or something like that. So they've been going. They've been going, and they're still going strong. And now we can go on to, excuse me, the Peninsula Museum of Art. We'll do a brief thing. There are three decidedly different exhibits there. The Goldfield Collection is oil paintings, etchings, pastels, screen prints, monotypes, and lithographs by internationally known artists collected over the years by Ronnie Goldfield. It is going to be there till June 8th. The next exhibition is 29 Hands, 15 Artists by Mark Kitaoka. Large black and white, low imagery pictures. They're very big, and they're very low image.
What does low image mean?
It's softer, and yet it's very specific. It doesn't hit you in the face when you look at it. But what he says about this, the 29 hands with 15 artists, says the hands of youth display the innocence of their owners. Scars, lines, and spots are the privilege of an experienced life. Interesting.
So these are pictures of hands
of artists.
Of artists.
Of 15 artists. Yes, doing what they do, which is part of, some of them might have a part of the face of the artist, but not necessarily. It's really looking at their hands, describing what their work is when they're doing their art, which is quite interesting. And then the last part is woven bronze sculptures by Virginia Harrison. It's an outstandingly unusual and beautiful form of art, very, very fine wires. She makes wall hangings of bronze. She makes outstanding pieces. It's delicate, delicate weaving of a very fine piece of bronze, if you can imagine such a thing. And she creates large or small things, something that remind me of musical instruments, because they start small and they open up like a flower would. Others remind me of chamber pots or chimney pots, not chamber pots, chimney pots. And she also has circular wall hangings, backlit, so that you can see the fine wires going around them. It will be there. Oh, and her work, it can take any place from a week to several months to fix. So it will be there till July 20th, and that's at the Peninsula Museum of Art, 1777 California Drive, open Wednesday through Sunday, 11 to 5.
California Drive in
Burlingame.
Oh, in Burlingame.
Yes, that's probably an important thing, because there's lots of California drives all over the place. And the last thing that I have is Christopher Buckley, the man who brought you Thank You for Smoking, has written another book. It's called But Enough About You, which is kind of Christopher Buckley-ish anyway. It's quite interesting because it has the things are pieces that were in The New Yorker or The Atlantic Monthly, The Daily Beast, all kinds of things. It's 9 segments with 89 vignettes. There's 411 pages. It's a big book. And it's a typical Christopher Buckley book. But the thing that I thought was the most fun that so far of what I've read is his horoscope. Now, we have, Sarah and I are both Virgos, and I have that. And Mark, who is coming up, is a Gemini, and our board operator today is, what are you? You're Aquarius, yeah. But I'm going to start with a couple of them because I think that they're really funny. I mean, he's written them exactly the way you would put them in the paper or magazine that people check every day. Okay, here we go, Virgo. You and I are going to have this. Jupiter just passed through your fifth house and left it a mess. However, there are several good cleaning services that specialize in moping up after large planets. If your business partner is an Aries, he's probably cheating you, but don't worry. An asteroid shower is passing through his house. However, now is the time not to run for Congress or re-gravel the driveway. So there's yours. Okay, now we're going to go on to Kevin. Kevin, you are an Aquarius, and it says, Kevin, do not engage in any element activities such as bungee jumping, skydiving, or playing professional basketball. Instead, concentrate on indoor activities such as baking cakes, vascular surgery, and inside training. It's also a good time to recharge your intellectual batteries. Recite Proust out loud in Pig Latin. Remembrance Ray of Hings Te Ast Pe, but be wary of voices you hear that aren't really there. And now we can go on to our Leo friend. It says, watch out for radioactive bags of potato chips, rivers of molten lava, and people who introduce themselves only as Turk. Keep your left arm straight and your chin down and listen to Aries, but say you'll have to get back to him. Avoid asparagus and manatees. Now, I think those are absolutely wonderful because they have about as much sense to them as the ones that are in the paper. But but it's a typical Christopher Buckley approach to the things that he does. I mean, the books that he's written, some of them are so very, very funny that you laugh out loud while you're reading them. And I was laughing out loud reading the horoscopes.
Christopher Buckley, but enough about you. Who is the publisher?
The publisher is... I'll have to look. The publisher is Simon & Schuster.
Ah.
It says, yes, Simon & Schuster, and has a story about Christopher Buckley and his friends. You know, he wrote Losing Mom and Pop, and he wrote so many funny small stories about Washington from the inside, from a very satiric point of view that went opposite to what his father thought, who was a very, very strong man. But Christopher Buckley has come up with some excellent, excellent things. Now, if I may, I just have a couple of things I want to talk about coming attractions. So we've got music and we've got theater coming. On June 4th, Marry Me a Little. It's a Sondheim show coming to Theater Works in Palo Alto. On June 20th, Broadway by the Bay is going to have In the Heights. Now, Broadway by the Bay is in San Mateo, and it starts on June 20th. On June 7th, there is Jazz on the Hill. It's free, and it's at the College of San Mateo. They've been doing it for years, and you have lots and lots of jazz artists coming up there to play. On June 23rd, there is a free concert in the park by the Peninsula Symphony in Los Altos. So there's lots of music and lots of theaters to go to, and all in June. So I think it's a wonderful time to look forward to what's going to be coming this summer.
Absolutely. Great.
Yeah, it's been fun to be here, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
And Kevin, it's nice to see you, too.
Started real slow. Keep on turning up the voltage till that man begin to glow like a switch and on a light bulb. Watch the juice begin to flow. Now the kind of blood tension. Here's what you really need to hear.
Watch out now.
music from The Color Purple, the musical, currently at the Hill Barn Theater. I'm Sarah Cahill, filling in for David LaTulippe here on Open Air on KALW. And my guest now is Mark Kenward. Your solo show is at the Marsh now. It's called Nantucket.
That's right. It's at the Marsh Berkeley.
Marsh Berkeley, we should say.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And Nantucket is such an exotic place here in California.
It is. Well, the East Coast is kind of an exotic place. and Nantucket, for sure. I mean, it's a place that resides in, you know, some part of the American imagination, particularly if you're from the East Coast, you know, was the whaling capital of the world.
Moby Dick.
Moby Dick. That's where the Pequot set sail. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, yeah. And now it's, you know, it's become a very expensive place. You know, a lot of famous people there spending the summers. And so, so it has that place in our imagination.
And this, the press release says, haunting yet hilarious memoir. And I'm thinking of the words haunting and hilarious together. That's a lot to handle.
It can be. You know, there's a lot of comedy in my piece, but it's a story of a family. I was born in Normal, Illinois. And when I was 8 years old, my family moved just for the heck of it to Nantucket Island. And they arrived with all the dreams you would expect of people moving to an island. But as beautiful as the place is, living on an island is just not, you know, it's not the same thing as being on vacation. And so, you know, the winters are long after the tourists go and, you know, all the beautiful people leave. You're left there. It's gray. You know, you're hammered by one nor'easter after another, looking at the same damn faces in the grocery store. And, you know, things happen. And certainly one of those things happened in my family. After we'd been there for 8 or 9 years, my mother committed a violent crime that shocked the local community. And
can you tell us what it was?
I don't want to spoil, you know, no spoilers, but it was something that, she nearly killed someone. And as I said, it shocked the community. And in a way, that's part of the story of an island. You know, it's beautiful, but it's isolated. The winters are long. Things happen. I mean, there was always something happening on Nantucket. I graduated with 48 kids, or 24 boys, and 12 of us went to college. And of the 12 who stayed, 4 were dead within a few years from different things, you know, drunk driving and things like that. So there's this other side. Basically, there's this other side of paradise, and the piece looks at that. That said, that may sound a little gloomy or, you know, but, you know, New England. But there is a lot of humor in the piece. Yeah. I mean, I enjoy, you know, having fun.
Now, this is your 8th solo show, is that right?
Yeah, 7th or 8th, depending on how you count. I've done a number of runs at the Marsh Theater, and I've toured shows to, you know, festivals and theaters around the country. Yeah,
you're already very vulnerable getting up there and doing a solo show, but, I mean, to throw in the memoir, autobiographical aspect of it, that's even, I mean, is that more so?
I think so. Yeah, probably. Yeah, because I've done a number of kinds of pieces. I've adapted literature. I've done, you know, pieces adapted from history, a little bit of fiction work. So, yeah, it's a little bit more, I guess, exposed, depending on what you're doing. But, you know, this is a story that, you know, I've been with for a long time, obviously, growing up there and everything that happened. And, you know, there's just a part of me that, you know, that it was inevitable to tell this story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You also direct other people in solo performances, and Nantucket, your new work, is directed by Rebecca Fisher, who is also a performer. And I wonder what that kind of relationship is like when you have only two people, a director and a performer, and you both have experience on both sides.
So. Oh, well, it's been amazing because it's really been a collaboration. I mean, we both have experience as performers, and we've been working together for the past 3 years. And in a way, it's like we've been discovering together all the possibilities of the form. In this piece, I use a lot of different modes, performing modes. There are times where I'm connecting directly to the audience, playing characters, different kinds of sub-narrators that can exist in a piece. I mean, there's the narrator of me as, you know, present tense. Then there's the kid narrating from within the scene. And so, and then even the character sort of narrating their own, you know, experiences. So we've been discovering together all the possibilities of the form, and it's just been thrilling.
You've been working for 3 years?
On this piece, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now you have to direct her solo show next, right?
No, I don't direct her show, but she's got a director on her own piece that's going to be coming up, I think, in the fall. It's called Memphis on My Mind. She's a wonderful performer.
Rebecca Fisher.
Yeah.
And this is at the Marsh in Berkeley.
Yep.
It's on Alston Way, 2120 Alston Way, above Shattuck, and runs through June 14th. And the
Exciting news. We're extending through July 19th.
July 19th.
Yes, we've had this
More
is our fourth weekend. We've had full houses. There's great buzz. There's great energy around the show. So we've added 5 more weeks of performances.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And I think you have a code for listeners this afternoon.
I do. I do. And I have a couple other things. But one thing I want to tell people is it's really exciting. We're serving a New England picnic dinner during the show. It's from Gregoire, which he's got a couple restaurants in the East Bay. Great sandwiches and exceptional chowder available for purchase during intermission. And it's a little bit of a longer intermission. It's about 30, 35 minutes long. And on Saturday nights, we have live music, musicians who have actually worked up some island classics or music sort of appropriate for a beach bar. So it's got more of a feeling of an event, and people have really been enjoying that part of the experience.
So that happens, you're doing the show, and there's an intermission, and then there's music and food?
Right. Well, the Marsh Berkeley has two spaces. So they have in the front, they've got a cabaret space, and then they've got their main stage. So I perform on the main stage, and then intermission, everyone moves to the cabaret space where the live music and has a feeling of a beach bar.
Fabulous.
And yes, we have a special discount for listeners, $5 off per ticket. You go to themarsh.org, and when you get to the final ticketing screen for Nantucket, you enter this special code, KALW.
Great.
All right. And again, that's $5 off per ticket. This offer expires tomorrow at midnight, but you can purchase tickets for any of our performances now through July 19th.
Well, thank you. That's wonderful. Themarsh.org.
Yeah.
So do you tell any limericks during the show?
I do. Unfortunately, I can't repeat it. I saw the FCC binder over there, so I do do a limerick, and you'll have to come to the show.
Uh-huh. How did you end up in the Bay Area?
You know, I was at Northwestern University for a graduate program for theater, and I went into the library. They had a rack of the current magazines, and there was American Theater Magazine. This was 1993, so over 20 years ago. And on the cover was Josh Kornbluth, and it said something like, San Francisco, capital of solo performance. And that's what I had been doing at Northwestern. I found, about a year or two later, I found my way out here. I first performed at the Marsh, at the Monday Night Marsh, in 1995. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. Can you give us any sort of little preview or?
Sure. I talk about a lot of different aspects of Nantucket and, the history of the place, the landscape. And Nantucket, I mean, you're stuck out there on this pile of sand, a pile of sand that hasn't even been there that long, 18,000 years. That's nothing in terms of geology. For millions of years, there's nothing but water. And then along come the huge glaciers of the last ice age, bulldozing gigatons of sand and rock. Earth just happens to warm up a little bit. Glaciers melt, recede, leaving behind this arm of sand off the coast. Glaciers keep melting. Sea keeps rising, churning, sculpting this arm of sand into Cape Cod and splitting off from it the islands, Cuttyhunk, the Vineyard, and way out there, Nantucket. And it's held together by this mere skin of grasses and shrubs. It's pushed around by centuries of storms, tides. One decade, a hurricane blows through. It cuts off Smith's Point, which is renamed Esther's Island. A few decades later, the sand builds back up. It's Smith's Point again. Beaches I knew as a kid, they look different. There's more sand here, less sand there. And out along the Sconset Bluff and the South Shore, sometimes during winter storms, houses just tumble into the sea. And there are other houses, they've moved back from the shore, not just once, but two or even three times. And this is the essence of the place. It's kind of beautiful, kind of depressing. When you really feel into the island, things can seem so fragile.
Wonderful, wonderful. That's Mark Kenward, from his solo show Nantucket, which is currently at the Marsh in Berkeley, running through, extended to July 19th.
Extended to July
19th? Because you've got such big audiences.
The big audiences, some good reviews out there. Yeah, things are going well.
Wonderful. And it's Thursdays and Saturdays.
Thursdays and Saturdays with the live music on Saturdays
during 7 o'clock.
And every night with your ticket comes a New England picnic dinner. New England picnic dinner.
And the Marsh is at 2120 Alston Way in Berkeley.
Yeah, downtown Berkeley.
Good place to perform. How does it compare to the Marsh in San Francisco
for you? It's great. The Marsh Berkeley has been there for years, but it's like a new venue now. We just brought in risers and into the space. It's beautiful. It's like the best venue now for solo performance, I think, in the Bay Area. It's really great.
Do you ever get hecklers?
No. Not in the Bay Area. Not in the Bay Area. I was once heckled in, I was performing in Winnipeg, and I was heckled by, it was a bar, and they forgot to kick out the clientele before my show. I was heckled by some hockey players.
Ooh.
Yeah, that was rough.
That's dangerous, too.
Yeah,
you can't really talk back.
But actually, the audience, they were heckling me for a while and talking, and the audience actually got up with me, and we went and kicked them out. So there you go, the power of theater.
The power of the masses.
Yeah, exactly.
Great. Well, thank you. What are you working on next?
Well, I'm directing some pieces. I've directed a number of shows. I directed Kurt Bodden, who was on the show, Steve Seabrook, Better Than You. I've got some pieces coming up. I have David Kleinberg's taking a new piece to the Capitol Fringe Festival in Washington, D.C. I've got clients performing at the Boulder Fringe Festival and, round and about. Howard Petrick, who's taking a piece on the Canadian Fringe Tour.
Before I let you go, let me just ask you a little bit about writing.
Yeah.
So you've been working on this for 3 years. What is the process of, I mean, do you do it on paper? Do you sort of talk things through? Do you speak and then type? And
everything.
Then you
I've transcribed, absolutely, where I've been in a room with my director or a little workshop group of fellow artists and just, riffing. And then transcribing that. So that's one way. Writing things out by hand, typing, whatever works. And I found that with each piece kind of has its own process. Some pieces, I had one piece that came almost exclusively out of improvisation, but others have been very much, hammered out at the computer.
Because it's obviously something that you go by sound. I mean, you don't just sit at the computer.
Absolutely.
And
the rhythm, words, how things land, how things live in the space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because the bit you performed just a moment ago definitely had that quality, that sort of the cadence of the rhythm.
Right.
Yeah.
The spoken word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Great. Thank you so much, Mark Kenward.
Thank you, Sarah.
Your Nantucket is through July 19th at the Marsh in Berkeley, Thursdays and Saturdays. You look at themarsh.org for more information. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
How they run, but when they hear the bells gun, because the western folk all know he's a highfalutin, tootin', shootin' son of a gun from Arizona, ragtime cowboy Joe. Out in Arizona where the bad men are, the only friend to guide him is the evening star. The roughest and the toughest man by far is Tim McNamara. He got his name from singing to the cattle and sheep. At night on stage he sings the girls to sleep. In a bass so rich and deep, crooning soft and low, he always lay at your lay, oh, oh, your low.
You're listening to Open Air, the weekly magazine of arts and culture here on KALW. I'm Sarah Cahill, filling in for host David LaTulipe while he's away in Scotland. Just a reminder that you can listen to Open Air during the week at our website, kalw.org. And special thanks to producer Neil Swinkles and board operator Kevin Vance today. Peter Robinson, it's great to see you again.
Good to be here. And I thought we may kick off with a little bit of real Wild West music. So let's have a tune. Let's hopefully have a tune.
Keep always sing raggedy music to the cattle as they swing back and forward in the saddle on a horse that was syncopated, gated. There was such a funny meter to the roar of his repeater, how they run when they hear the fellow's gun. And the western folks all know he's a highfalutin', rootin', tootin' son of a gun from Arizona, ragtime cowboy Joe.
Now out in Arizona where the bad men are, the only friend to guide you is that evening star.
Now, however lyrical and happy this happy-go-western tune may be, I think what has been on my mind is how do you cope with the National Rifle Association? It seems to me that the news at 6 always begins with one item. If it bleeds, it leads. And when I look back on this last year, whether it's shootings at school, shootings in cinema, shootings at military bases, shootings in the street, shootings at hamburger joints, I have been thinking deeply, what can I do as a concerned and hopefully useful citizen? Well, of course, radio is the theatre of the mind. It's about words. And what I wanted to look just for a second is whether language, in fact, is a loaded weapon. And when I say whether it's a loaded weapon, I'm thinking with politicians, if they're quick on the draw and it's a shot in the dark, it could be possible that they may miss. And if they do miss, then they're probably going to have to bite the bullet. Now, if they bite the bullet, they do get a second shot in which case they could be trigger happy. Now, I'm looking at these words and I'm saying to myself, am I guilty of using them? And the quick answer is, yes, I am. They have permeated into the possessive form of my everyday talk. They are part of how I speak. And of course, the Brits aren't exempt, although I do come from a country where the police don't carry guns, which, of course, is a very useful reminder, a good way of avoiding getting shot. Now, take the consequences, for example, of being trigger happy. Trigger happy can often lead to being a hot shot. And the way the adjective is used, you've got hot shot lawyers, hot shot politicians, hot shot journalists. In fact, hot shots are everywhere around the corner. And if they don't deviate from their case, then, of course, they are indeed a straight shooter. Now, all these words keep coming in. And when you investigate the cause, what do you go looking for? You go looking for the smoking gun. Now, if you find the smoking gun and the person remains obstinate, what does he do? He sticks to his guns. And if indeed he sticks to his guns, the person interrupts, in which case he jumps the gun. And that immediately puts the shooter under pressure, in which case he's under the gun. Now, all this keeps on worrying me, because the only way out is to come in with all guns blazing. And by now, you're really in a fix, whether you're trigger happy, whether you've missed the shot. But what you may want to do is hold back, in which case you keep your powder dry. And keeping your powder dry is, of course, a very, very ingenious policy for really blowing the enemy's head off when the time proves propitious. Now, when I think back this year, and I think back to Fort Hood, I think back about the NRA lobbyists, and I think about the difficult debate that is yet to take place, despite all the promises, I wonder, in the end, about compliments. And if that's not enough troubleshooting, when somebody says to me, "You son of a gun," I'm left with that very ambiguous question. Is that a compliment or is that a put-down? And there I go. Let's hear it one more time for our old friend, Ragtime Cowboy Joe. Well, by way of contrast, I this week have been to the movies and I've seen what I consider to be an excellent romantic period drama called Belle. It's spelt B-E-L-L-E, and it's set in the England of 1769. This is Jane Austen country. In fact, I would call it Pride with Prejudice in this case, because it is a very, very interesting story based on a true life case in which the lead character, Dido Elizabeth Belle, an African-American, a daughter of a British admiral, Sir John Lindsay, and her mother, an enslaved African woman, Maria Belle. But she, when her father, who's an admiral, is sent off to the outposts of empire, is put under the care of her father's uncle, William Murray, who happens to be the Earl of Mansfield. But he also, and this is the trick in the case, happens to be the Chief Justice. He rules over cases that, of course, involve slavery. And we are looking at an England at the end of the 18th century when slavery is still ripe. Now, I think it's a superb performance by Gunga Mbatha Raw, who plays Dido. She, in this role, is a very confused woman, since she exists in a state of limbo. She's too high-born to mingle with commoners, but too dark-skinned to eat dinner at the table with her own family. And that, of course, is the essence of the first of several dilemmas in this fabulous costume movie. She's raised with her cousin, Elizabeth, played by Sarah Garden, who was abandoned by her father, and they grow up really like sisters, although Dido isn't afforded the certain basic accommodation that Elizabeth has, yet Dido, on the other hand, has a certain order of things. She feels loved by her adoptive parents, her great-aunt and her great-uncle, played by Tom Wilkinson, and as the household develops, you begin to see that when Dido's father's died, she is a rich woman. So in other words, she does not, as in every Jane Austen story, have to find a husband to support her. She has independent money, whereas her assumed sister has no money, but of course fits into the English social class. So the story progresses when it comes to a moment of romance. And Dido, although offered and a suitable British aristocrat, falls for a lawyer who is a passionate anti-slaver, an abolitionist. And this, of course, poses problems. But the movie operates at many different levels, and I began at the beginning saying that Lord Mansfield is Lord Chief Justice. And the key case in this case is the story about a slave-trading boat where 142 slaves were forced overboard because supplies were running well. But it's not a story about slaves overboard. It's a story about insurance fraud and whether the insurance company should be compensated for the loss of the cargo. So it has indeed lots of interesting twists. It's not a murder. It's an insurance case. And as a male, I don't mind saying I'm an emotional moviegoer. So I ended up with a few tears at the end when the romance came to fruition and everything happened and ended happily. But that's not a spoiler. You'll be gripping in your seat to see how it gets resolved. The costumes are great. The character acting is superb. The plot is ingenious. Now, very interesting, the story is based on a real-life case known as the Zong Massacre case. And in fact, it wouldn't be until 1833 that Britain ultimately abolished slavery. Top film running at cinemas here in the city and in Marin and in the East Bay. Don't miss it. It's called Belle. As a preview, and I'm sort of stressing it's a preview, I want to draw attention to a small company called Word for Word. And if you haven't been to one of their productions, they literally produce a play where they say every word. So if, for example, the text has he said or she said, then that is included in the dialogue. And this is 36 stories based by the wonderful Sam Shepard. It's adopted and directed by Amy Cosso. It's running at Z Space, which is down there on Florida Street, and it opens this Saturday, runs till June the 22nd. Don't miss it. It's Z Space, Word for Word's production of 36 stories by Sam Shepard, and the opening night is this Saturday.
Thank you so much, Peter Robinson. That's a great roundup of things. That's that word for word sounds terrific. And Belle, too. I'd like to see that.
Yeah, two great, a great movie and a great play. And certainly I find with word for word productions that you listen up. You listen up because they are speaking to each other. And like many small space theatres, the intimacy and the distance between the actor and the audience is small. So you're in the play from the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. And I should mention that someone from Word for Word will be here on Open Air sometime in the next few weeks. So stay tuned for that.
Good. Thank you, Sarah. Good to be here.
Thank you very much. Special thanks to Open Air producer Neil Swinkles and board operator Kevin Vance for making today's show possible. You've been listening to Open Air here on KALW San Francisco. I'm Sarah Cahill. A reminder that you can hear this or any recent editions of Open Air at our website, kalw.org. David LaTulipe will be back hosting this show next week, and join me this coming Sunday evening for Revolutions Per Minute, 2 hours of new and classical music from 8 to 10 p.m. My guest will be Guy Klusevic. Thanks for listening.